Then I'd ask you to help me welcome Julie L. from Tahunga as our speaker tonight.
Julie Alcoholic. I love that this microphone is appropriately placed. Because normally I'm like fiddling around with that business, you know. I'm 4'11", but I sound tall. So I don't really need the mic, but I'm delighted that it's like, all right, here it is. And I think you can see my face. Normally people are like, I wondered what you looked like. Like, oh my God. So thanks, Lee, for inviting me. Thanks, Hilda, for driving. Came up from Los Angeles to Tahunga today. Took a couple of hours, and it's all good, right? We get to show up, and we get to say yes. The accent is Irish, I know. I was speaking somewhere one time, which shall remain nameless, and somebody, before I spoke, somebody said to me, oh, you have an accent. And I was like, yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, what is it? And I say, it's an Irish accent. And she says, oh, have you ever been? And I was the speaker, so I didn't want to be rough, you know? So I took everything in me, and I'm like, yeah, I was born there. Like, what do you think I do? Go home and watch BBC and try to emulate an accent? Now, don't get me wrong, I've met people who do that. Or like, you know, I meet people, I've talked to them for 5 minutes and they start talking with my accent. And they're like, oh my God, I just do this every time. And I'm like, okay. I think that's diagnosable, but all right. So who am I to say that? So, you know, I was born and raised in Ireland, and what did they say? God created whiskey to stop the Irish from taking over the world. And my mom had 13 children from the age of 15 up to 27. They call that in Ireland Irish twins, you know, it's like 10 months, every 10 months. She had a couple of twins. 7 passed away when they were babies, and so there's 6 of us left. And then she, you know, it was kind of wild in my house. There was a lot of alcoholism and a lot of violence and all that business. And you know, my mother was not really maternal. And what I mean by that is, like, one day we're going up through an escalator, you know, and I see this heavily pregnant woman coming up the escalator. And my mother looks at me, she looks at her, and she goes, Jesus, someone had it in for her. And I was like, Mammy, maybe she wants to be pregnant. And she goes, Julie, no one wants to be pregnant. So that was a woman who had 13 children. So I'm like, all right then, warm and fuzzy. And that was a problem when I got sober, because I was not warm and fuzzy. And I thought, if you were warm and fuzzy, you were weird. And I want you far away from me. As I've got older in my sobriety, I've become somewhat warm and fuzzy. Only a little bit. I won't go, my wife's like, really? So, you know, I was raised in this home. There's a lot going on. And my mother left my father when I was like 4 or 5. And we lived in London in a council property. And my mom used to go back to Ireland every 7 weeks. That was a school holiday in London. And we'd go back to Ireland. And my mother used to smuggle back moonshine, like what we call in Ireland poutine, and she'd smuggle back this poutine, and it was like 6 children in the car, all like little steps, and my mother, who never in her life ever had a driver's license ever, but drove her whole life, she always did a lot of fake driver's license. She was involved in a bit of criminal activity, and so she'd smuggle this poutine home, you know, and they'd open up the trunk on the customs, and she'd have them in statues of the Blessed Virgin Mary. You know, the holy water bottle statues where you put the holy water in, you bless yourself when you're feeling a little queer, which I did regularly, drinking it, you know what I'm saying? So she'd empty out the water and she'd put in the poutine. And it looked like she was super religious when they popped the trunk, you know? And they'd flag her on, oh, thanks, officer, you know? And we had this drinks cabinet at home, and she'd put these statues of Mary up in the drinks cabinet. And I learned at a very early age how to open that drinks cabinet without the magnet making a click, click noise. And I thought it was a sign from Jesus. I'm like, Jesus wants me in here, obviously. Because this is a skill I didn't know I had. So I think it was God inspired. And so, you know, I'd put my hand up. My mother was always out. She was a bar fly, my mother, the same as I am. And my mother was always out, and so I'd open that cabinet and I'd find Mary. I'd screw the head off Mary, and I would have a swig of that poutine. And I don't know how moonshine is, but when you drink poutine, you actually can't breathe. It's like you take a hit off that and you're like, and you know, your veins are popping out. It's like you can feel the pulse. And you know it's going to be so worth it. Once you're able to breathe again, it's going to be good. And it always was. And I'd put Mary's head back on, and I'd put her back in the cabinet, and I'd be delighted with myself for like 20 minutes. I'm smoking cigarette butts, and I'm dancing, having a grand old time on my own, because, you know, I'm totally antisocial when I drink. So I always was. And so I'm kind of antisocial sober, but, you know, drinking, I'm like, all right, so I'm having a good old time. And then like 20 minutes would pass, and I'd be like, let's see what Mary's doing. And we're back up looking for Mary, and that'd be it. And that was my drinking. And I want to say this, like I don't know about this invisible line business. I've never had social drinking. I've never had an invisible line. When I started drinking, like, I was independently drinking at the age of 10. I loved everything about it. Like, before I drank, I was very concerned all the time. Like, I was wound tight, as you can tell. I'm still wound tight. You know, I'm wound tight, right? I was concerned about everybody and what everybody's opinions was about me and what was going on. And when I drank, that left me. And I became super indifferent about you and your sad little life. And you and your sad little opinions. And I love that. It was such a freedom for me. Now, when I got sober, my first 10 years of sobriety, I had 2 ulcers because I got very concerned again. So I had to practice not being so concerned all the time. I still do. I exercise a lot. And I do a lot of prayer meditation because left to my own devices, I get concerned. I'm high strung. And so I love that about booze. Like that left me and it felt like I could breathe. And if you're new and if you're not so new and you don't identify with this next piece, you don't have to. It's just my experience. I like to share it because it's amazing how many people do identify with it. But as soon as I started drinking like that, I suddenly had a great idea that would be a great idea to cut myself, right? That's a great idea. And I started to cut myself and hide, wear long sleeves all the time and just hide my arms. That was always part of my drinking. Now, at the age of 10, that was a good idea to me. As soon as I started drinking like that, I started to cut myself. And that followed me all the way through my drinking until I got sober. And it was like my big secret. It was like my own thing going on. And so that was how it was. So like at the age of 10, that's how it was for me. And you'd be glad to know I got sober at 24. So I had like 14 years like that. And, you know, I started to drink at school. And I went to Catholic school, of course, I'm Irish. And went to Catholic school. And I'd have my little uniform on. And over on, we'd have lunch break. And there was a little corner store. And I'd run in there at lunchtime with my lunch money. And I'd buy 4 cans of wine. Cans of wine. Really? Like, I don't even think it had seen a grape. And I wasn't concerned about it being chilled. You know what I'm saying? I'm not even glamouring it up. Like, I, right from the gate, just drank for effect. I wasn't interested in what it tastes. I couldn't care less. And so I didn't have that verbiage, of course, when I started drinking, but I just, that's what you did. And so I'd grab those 4 cans of wine. I'd go into the toilets alone, because I'm not a sharer, and I'd pound down those 4 cans. And then I'd be good. Now, I'm cursed being Irish, and I'll tell you why. When I drink, I go like red, almost purple, from the neck, you know, all the way up. I'm like, and my eyes are like piss holes in the snow. Right? You ever seen that? I know you're Californians, but use your imagination. There's not much snow going on here. But it was like, so like my, I'm like, whoop, 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 and I'm like red and crazed. And always have been with drinking me. It's just how I roll. And I'd go back to class and people would go, oh, are you okay? And I'm like, I'm good. And I had a parent who was caught up in her own alcoholism. And I don't know about you guys, but for me, my mother never paid attention. There was a lot of violence in my home, but there was a lot of violence in my home, but there was very little discipline. Like, nobody was seeing if I was going to school. Nobody was seeing where I was. I just did my own thing, which is such a detriment when you first get sober, isn't it? Because, you know, people say to you, well, can you get some, like, 4 regular meetings a week? You're like, what now? Like, what? Like, show up consistently somewhere? Like, I want to do my own thing. If I want to get up during the meeting and have a cup of coffee and go and scratch myself outside, that's what I'm going to do. Like, I'm not thinking about you. Like, I'm undisciplined. And I grew up undisciplined. There was, like, no expectations of me, and I lived up to every single one of them. And the only expectation was that my mother never wanted the police at the house because she was involved in quite a bit of criminal activity. We'll say no more. And so, you know, that was always like an unspoken thing. But I was raised with this lack of discipline. I say that to my sponsees now. I'm like, well, lack of discipline is your dilemma. And they're like, what? And I'm like, exactly. So it's like, I just do what I feel like. I just do what I feel like. And I start, and they don't like that at school because you don't show up for things. I started to work in an Irish club at night, and I started to get my booze at the Irish club. And, you know, they'd put the shutters down. I was used to collect glasses, you know, and they'd put the shutters down. I was like 14. And I'd put my hand straight up to the optics and I'd get whatever was gone. Because I told you, I'm not drinking for the taste. Whatever I can reach is what I'm getting. I'm going to fill that glass up. I'm going to shoot that down as I'm pouring my pint. And it was all right to pour my pint. They were all right with me drinking because I was after working all night. And my boss said, oh, now Julia, which drove me crazy because my name's not Julia, but okay, fine. Like, and then I'd cut myself because I was doing the glasses, and if a glass broke, I'd just instantly cut myself. I was a total mess. And I'd be hiding all that stuff. So it was like really crazy. And I left school and started to work in the East End of London in a hospital. Sorry. In a hospice, because I'm laughing because I had no business there. Like, if somebody died, I'd be like, oh, but I'd be going to the girls, ah, Jez, I'm sorry, do you want to go for a drink? You know what I mean? Like, I had no concern for anybody. It was like a drinking opportunity. And I started to work in the East End, and I asked them that they would put me, I left home when I was 19, started to work in the East End. And I asked them if they would put me East End of London. And I should finish my sentence, shouldn't I? You're like, East End of what? East End of what? East End of London. And everybody with me? Yeah. Awesome. And I asked them if they would put me on the floor with the nuns. Yeah. Because I was going to enter religious life. And it was ran by the Irish Sisters of Charity, and I thought I had a big cross on me and said, I'm in a big cross, like almost like carrying it. And I'm like, it was a big brass cross on a leather strap, and I'd be like, I'm going to enter religious life. Could I be on the floor with the other sisters? And they're like, oh yes, of course. That was their first mistake. Because as soon as I got there, I started drinking. I had this wardrobe that had a lock on it. And you open the wardrobe and on top was like whiskey, vodka, anything else, Pilsner lager, and my razor blades. And then my clothes were thrown in the bottom and that was it. That was how it was. But that was, my rest of my room was immaculate. Like you could eat out of the bin. And I had that and it was my little secret thing. I'd open that and I started drinking and carrying on there, and I was cutting myself and carrying on, and I'd be listening to Guns N' Roses. You know, they're like, turn around, bitch, I got use for you. Besides, you ain't got nothing better to do, and I'm bored. And I'm like, yeah, crazy. Bottle of whiskey, pack of razor blades, and I'm like rolling. I don't need anybody. It is like, damn, I'm having an awesome time here on my own. And, you know, people would be tapping at the door, and they'd be like, Julie, love, are you okay? And I'd put my empties in their bins. At night, we'd have to put our bins outside the door, and I'd put my empties in Sister Anne's bin. And in the morning, I'd hear the other girls, the domestic staff. My accent is from the Midlands, and the domestic staff was from a different part of Ireland. And I'd hear them all. They'd be down in the kitchen going, Jesus, girl, did you see Sister Anne's bin? I think she's a bit of an alky. And I'm like, ah, that was hilarious. So, I was so irreverent, and I thought I wasn't, and I thought it was like really, you know, special. So I started to get into a lot of trouble. I was drinking on the unit. I was like two doors down. You remember that Dolly Parton song? Two doors down, they're laughing and drinking and having a... Two doors down, they don't know I'm around, right? So my room was two doors down. And like I thought, again, that was a sign from Jesus that I should go and have a drink because I'm two doors down and I love Dolly Parton because I'm crazy. So I started getting into a lot of trouble. I started to find my local across the road, and they have what you call in Britain a lock-in. So the bar closes at 11, and if you're a local there and you work in the hospice, you know, very spiritual, then they let you spend the night there. And you drink, you clean up a few ashtrays and you clean the toilets or whatever you're doing. And they let you sit at the bar and you're there until 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And that was what I did daily. And I started to get into a lot of trouble with booze because, first of all, if you haven't noticed, I have a mouth and a half on me. And being 4'11", I feel like people are always like, what? I'm like, shh, don't speak, you'll spoil it. Like I'd abuse people and then I'd, you know, assault them and then I'd wander off. And they'd be like, what? And they'd be like this, what? What? I was being the biggest guy there to abuse and then wander off. You know, and one night I was there and some guy goes to me, a guy asked me on a date. And I went and he said to me, and I don't even know, I was coming in and out of blackout because I'm a huge blackout drinker. And I come out of blackout and I hear him saying to me, such a shame. He says, you have such a lovely smile, but you have a terrible mouth. And I told him where to go and continued on with my evening. But it's like, that's how I was. I was really hostile and I was getting more and more hostile at work. I was drinking. I was starting to cut myself where, you know, people couldn't stop the bleeding. I was calling people now because it was like so intense and I was getting so violent. So I started to want to control and enjoy my drinking. Lovely, right? That's a lovely spot to get in, isn't it? And I started to swim. I still swim a couple of miles a week. I'm a huge swimmer. So I'm in such good shape, you know. I know you're wondering. But it's like, I'm a huge swimmer. I like it because I don't have to speak to anybody and I drown my head for an hour. It's perfect. Perfect. And you know, I do my best thinking in the water and when everything's blocked out. And still love it for that reason. And I started to swim and I'd work a shift 7:30 to 12 o'clock. And then I'd rush up to the pool. I'd swim 80 laps or 100 laps in 80 minutes. And I'd be like, okay, that's great. Then I'd go double whiskey, double whiskey, double whiskey back to work. And I'm lit off. I've had no food. Now I'm going back for the split shift at 4:30. I'm trying to get a cup of coffee. I'm drunk. I drop the coffee mug. I cut myself because it's broken. And so you cut yourself with like a mess, right? I go back on the unit, put my cardigan on so nobody sees. And I'm drunk and people are, and I'm lit up. And people go, have you been drinking? I'm like, can you swim 100 laps in 60 minutes or 80 minutes? They'd be like, what? And I go, exactly. When you can, get back to me. And they're like what? So, you know, that's how it was. And I started to, I come out of blackout one morning and I find this cherry, glow-in-the-dark job, tracksuit. Like, it was right. And I figure it's mine because it's in my wardrobe. And I put it on, and my hair shaved. Like, this is quite long for me. I had my hair shaved on a one, on a number one. My hair was shaved, and I had this tracksuit, and I started to wear this luminous tracksuit. And now I'm lit up like a Christmas tree. And in the evening, I go in for, because I'm still entering religious life. Like, I'm dropped that thought. And, you know. And I'd go over to evening vespers with all the sisters, and they'd be singing. And I'd be standing in the back, lit up, with my cherry tracksuit and my hair shaved. And they'd be singing, and I'd be like, oh, look at them. They can't hold a tune. I'm going to help the sisters out. And I'm in the back like, Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae. And I'm so drunk, I'm like, Vite Dilcedo, Espes Nostra Salve. And I see them going, thanks, Julie. Now I realise they were like, what is that in the back of the room? But at the time, I thought it was like, that's why I'm saving you guys again. I'm holding the whole thing up. And then I'd go back for a drink, and I got more and more into trouble. And I want to say this, control and enjoying your drinking, like, I was never able to do that. I had great ideas that I was going to do that after some incomprehensible demoralization experiences. I thought, oh yeah, I'm not going to do that. And I wake up and I'm rough and I'm just in bits. And the pubs opened at that time at 11 a.m. But I'm not going to go and drink today because, you know, I really embarrassed myself last night. And, you know, 12 o'clock comes. Well, Jesus, you know, I think you're exaggerating a bit. And they had it coming and nobody really knew that was going. Oh, yeah, you're right. By 1 o'clock, I'm back over there and it's all over again. And here I am again in blackout, wondering how I got there. A couple of years ago, I remember I had a memory of going, ended up in, I came out of blackout and I was in the East End of London in a very rough neighbourhood, very rough neighbourhood. And I was in this biker den. And I don't know how I got there. A friend of mine at the nursing thing invited me. She was next to me with her boyfriend doing their thing. I come out of blackout. I don't know where I am. I'm in their garden. And I try and get out the house. And it was like, I don't know if you guys know these biker places. It's like one light bulb and it feels like it's swinging. You know what I mean? And there's no lampshade going on. It's like, and you're, there was no door on the toilet. And I knew I needed to go to the restroom, but there was no door. So I wandered out somewhere and next thing, and there's all the bikes on the dirt outside, and next thing I come to and I'm in my room back in the hospice. Like, I have no clue what was going on. And I started to get into a lot of trouble and really frightening stuff for me. And this idea, like, yeah, trying to control and enjoy my drinking, it never happened for me. I could go a couple of, I don't think I even, like, maybe I'd go a day and I'd tell somebody I haven't had a drink for a day. And they'd be like, yeah, and? But they didn't realise how hard that was for me. And, you know, I got a moment of clarity. I went to Australia. I saw an advert for Castlemaine Forex, which is a beer. And I went to Australia, and I was on a glass-bottom boat in the Barrier Reef, in the Great Barrier Reef. And I was 20 years of age. I was going to turn, I'm a Virgo. It's important for you all to know that. And because I'm in California, and what time are you? What? Anyway, so it was like August, and I was going to turn 21 in the September, and I was on this glass bottom boat, right? And I'm drinking a can of Foster's, and I've got long sleeves on me because I've been cutting myself, and there's girls my age, and they're all like, let's go stalking, right? And I'm like, oh my God, these women are pathetic. They're pathetic. Meanwhile, I'm sitting there with long sleeves on me. I won't get in a swimsuit because, or a bikini, God forbid, because I'm ashamed of my body. Now, I look back at pictures when I was 20 and I was banging, you know what I'm saying? But it's like, at 20, you're like, you know, like, whatever. So it's like, you know. So I get these, I'm there and I'm drinking this can so clearly and I start taking their inventory, how pathetic they are. Right? Ooh, let's get something. And I start taking pictures of the can of Foster's, which is actually a beautiful can. I'm not even playing. And the sun was hitting this can. And it's like beautiful blue, isn't it? Like that metallic blue. And the silver stars and the red. I mean, you know what I'm saying. And obsession much. And I'm taking pictures of how it's hitting the kangaroo. And I found those pictures. I have a lot of pictures of that can of Foster's. And I don't have one picture of the Great Barrier Reef. And it was a glass bottom bowl. Like, that's all I had to do was this, right? Excuse me a minute, Ken. I'm back. Right, that's all I had to do. It never happened. Like, I'm locked in. And I sit, look at that. I'm like, what was all about? It's obsession. So I come back. I had a really horrible experience. I ended up drinking a full bottle of brandy one night. And, you know, I felt like I was having a heart attack that night. And I was lying in bed and had horrible out-of-body experiences. Like, somebody was in the room. It was just horrible. So I'm like, I'm in a bad mood and I know something's going to have to happen. And I'm on the unit and somebody upsets me. And frankly, it's not difficult. I've always struggled with having a very short fuse. Short fuse. And I've had to work super hard on that, sober, like that. I'm like, and I come by honestly, both my parents are very short fuses. I do too. And it's something that I've had to work really hard on. And, you know, somebody's upset me. I go into my room and I'm drinking a bottle of whiskey and I'm looking out the window and I'm listening to Patsy Cline. And, you know, today I sat alone at a window, because I'm at a window, you know. I'm like, I don't want to play house. No, I don't want to play house, right? And I'm drinking me bottle of whiskey. And I wander over to the sink and I suddenly cut myself really badly. And I'm suddenly struck sober at 21. I'm suddenly struck sober. And I have a moment of clarity that I realise I can't live with booze and I can't live without it. And I picked up the bottle of whiskey and I drank for another 3.5 years. And it's a horrible place, you know, near the end of my drinking, it's a horrible place where you drink and drink and drink and drink and you can't get drunk. Like, your head is wide awake. Isn't that a terrible place, right? It's like my body's drunk, 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 and my head is like, oh my God, where am I? Oh my God, who is this guy? Oh my God, I'm wet in my pants. Can't move from the neck down, but my head is wide awake. Now I can't escape. So I understand what people say, booze stop working. In that way, for me, I could not escape my head anymore. And I'm wide awake to everything. And so I you know, I have my last hurrah, April 1993. So I'm like 26 and a three quarters, I guess, sober. And it's funny, I've been longer sober than I got sober when I was 24 and a half, and now I'm close to 27 years sober. And so it's been an interesting, like, I've created a life for myself. But, you know, so I had my last drink, and apparently in blackout, I'd escaped. I should have been working I was working in a retreat centre, a Catholic retreat centre with the Ursuline Sisters, because I'm still going to become a nun. It's in a convent. I'm drinking all day, and I go back like 1 o'clock in the morning, and they're having a reconciliation service. For non-Catholics, it means a forgiveness service. And I wonder, apparently in blackout, into the chapel, I'm bleeding everywhere because I've cut myself. I've smashed up my room. I'm very violent in booze, always have been. Anything that was worth anything to me. I've never met a wardrobe that I didn't like to beat the hell out of. And it's just a thing. Apparently I went into the chapel in front of 60 young people and I told Sister Anne where to go. And bled all over the carpet, which is never good because they're always cream, those carpets, aren't they, in the chapel? And anyway, it's never good. So I wake up the next morning, right, and I'm, like I said, I'm 24 and a half, and I'm like, okay. So I wake up, my arms are all ripped up. I'm really sick, shaken. My room is all smashed up, because I told you I like to put my fist through things when I'm drinking. My lamp is broken. I mean, it's a mess, right? 24. And I crawl to the bathroom and I start bringing up blood. And I realise that booze had stopped working for me. And I made a decision in that moment to kill myself. Absolutely, I'm dead serious about that. I realised in that moment, I had another moment of clarity, that I was a loser, and I was. I was a loser. I'd always worked somewhere. I left school with no education. I had no education when I left school. I had a hard time reading and writing. Both my parents are illiterate. My mother was semi-literate, but both of them, my father could hardly sign his name. Education was not a big thing. So I left school with no education. I had no friends because I'm rough with people. Very, very rough with people. I'm violent. People don't like that, apparently. Neither do wardrobes. So I realised that I was a loser. I'd never worked anywhere that I'd had to pay a bill. I'd always worked somewhere that they'd take the bills out first and then they'd give you what's left over. So, and I'd never driven a car. I'd never had a relationship. I mean, I had, like, obsessions, you know, but never a relationship. And I knew I was a loser. And I didn't have that verbiage then, but I do now. The idea of living life on life's terms was so overwhelming to me. Because what do you do when you get up at 8 o'clock in the morning? What do you do if you're not going to drink for the day? Like, I couldn't get my head around that. Like, I hated myself, and I knew other people hated me too, and I don't blame them. I wasn't. What did they say in the big book, The Alcoholic Sins Cups is an Unlovely Creature? And I was. I was very, very rough with people. And I slapped people down before they had a chance to even say anything. And I mistook kindness for weakness. And I didn't know that, of course. I thought I was the victim, that I was just defending myself all the time. And people were rough. That's what I thought. My perception was totally warped. And I make a decision to kill myself that morning. And I finish throwing up and I go upstairs. And I'm drinking some hot water, which is what I always drank when I was hungover, boiling water. And I'm shaking. And my arms were all ripped up. And there was a guy who brought this group to the house that night. And he saw me perform the night previously. And he was an Irish guy. And the only reason I listened to him was because he was Irish. Because, you know, the Irish and British are very different. And we all know that I live with all these British people. And we all know that they're like a bit anal. The British. And the Irish, we like to have a good time. You know, we let our hair down. So I knew when he talked to me that he knew me. And he turned out he was 9 months sober in alcoholics. 9 months. And he carried the message to me. And I've been sober as long as I have been because he bothered to carry the message to me. 9 months sober. He's still sober. I met somebody who met him a couple of weeks ago. And he carried the message to me, and he brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I knew about AA, but I'm like, you don't understand. In my house, this is what we do, this is what we are, and I don't care. I don't care. I couldn't care less. In that morning, I cared. And he 12-stepped me that morning, and he brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was on a Wednesday night. I remember it so clearly. I remember on a Wednesday night, I hadn't had a drink for a couple of days because I had to wait for the meeting. That was like a Saturday morning, and the meeting was Wednesday night, and I was ready for another drink. You know what I mean? Like, I've never gone 4 days without drinking. So he calls me, goes, I'm picking you up tonight. And so we go to this meeting in a place called Loughton in Epping Forest in London. And it was an 8:30 meeting until 10. And it was a real small, smoky room because it was 1993. And everyone was smoking. It was truly anonymous. You could not see your hand. And the speaker spoke, and I didn't really identify with the speaker, to be honest. I hadn't gone to prison, and I hadn't been in psychiatric hospitals, and I hadn't got DUI, all that, because my life was very small, and I was very shut down. So I never allowed people close enough to do any of that stuff for me. But I shared at my first meeting because I'm arrogant. I know. And that was a shock. I don't know if I'm alcoholic, but I do know that I can't stop drinking, that I get drunk at the wrong time, that I'm totally in obsession with drink, that I tell myself I'm not going to drink, I end up drinking, I end up in blackout, I end up cutting myself, all this stuff, over and over and over and over and over and over, and I don't know what to do. And anyway, somebody gave me a big book that night. It was really interesting. A woman gave me a big book, and I'm suspicious immediately. I'm like, what now? She put her name in the book, and I'm like, yeah, great. And so I go home. I wake up the next morning, and it's like, that was the longest I'd ever gone without a drink since I could remember. 5 days. And I was like, and I'm crazy. So I'm like, this AA really works. Right? I know, that's exactly what I thought. And so I ended up, all right, I'm going to get sober. And I don't remember, there was a song out, Constant Craving, at the time. And I bought that song because I was like, oh God, I was in obsession. I want to drink for about 17, 18 months on a daily basis. And it was, I got kind of caught up with ginger beer. It's not alcohol, it's ginger beer here. I think it's like ginger ale, but I like the way it kicked me in the back of the throat. And I was obsessed with cans of that stuff. A lot of sugar in it, and the ginger just kicked me in right in the neck, which is just exactly where I need to be kicked on a regular basis. And I started to go to meetings. And, you know, it's funny what they say, right? You know, be careful how you treat the newcomer, because one, they could be your sponsor. That's how it is here. And this woman who really, really helped me, she said to me one day, she didn't sponsor me, she's not interested in sponsoring me, but she picked me up and brought me to meetings, and she bought me a gift. You know, I got sober in the April, and I turned 25 in the September. And I was 5 months sober, and I thought my life is over, you know. And really, I didn't know it was just beginning, but she brought me a gift. She picked me up, and she brought me to the meeting, and she brought me a gift, right? And I was so awkward. I didn't want to open the gift in front of her. Like, what do you do when someone gets you a gift? For my 16th birthday, I said to my mother, it's my birthday today. She goes, ah, Jesus. After a few drinks, she went across the bar, over to the local confectionery, and she bought me a chocolate orange for 99 cents. She goes, here, happy effing birthday. And I was like, So, like, I got sober, and I was turning 25, and this woman gives me a gift, and it's beautifully wrapped. And she's kind in how she gives it to me, and it frightens the life out of me. I'm like, I don't do kindness at this time in my life. And so she hands me the gift, and I'm like, oh, thanks. And she goes, are you going to open it? I said, oh, I'm going to open it later. I was like, oh, please, Jesus, don't hug me on top of it, which she did. And I was like, oh. So I get out of the car and I open that gift. And it was a beautiful bottle of perfume. Now, I was rough. I wasn't wearing perfume at that time in my life. Tonight, I've even got mascara on. Hello. Yeah. You too can have what I've got. So this is my girly look. I've got a bit of cleavage going. It's all good. Like, oh, my God. I know. So she gives me this perfume. It was called Tuscany perfume, and nobody had ever bought me perfume before, and I went to the chemist to see how much it was. How much am I really worth to her? And it was an expensive bottle of perfume, and I wore that perfume probably about 15 years of my sobriety. I just kept buying it because it reminded me of her. And when I was 5 years sober, my friend Diane relapsed, who saved me. And she said to me one time, you'll get this, Julie, because you're honest. And she asked me to sponsor her. And I would have never stayed sober if it wasn't for Diane. I would have never. She didn't expect too much of me. She was kind to me. And I didn't understand that. It was like a puzzle to me when someone was kind. I didn't understand it. And she was kind without wanting anything from me. She'd bring me for coffee on a Friday night, and I was crazy and angry. And she'd bring me for coffee on a Friday night, and we'd go to Stansted Airport after the hospital meeting, and it was like a 40-minute drive, and she'd buy coffee. She'd buy me coffee, and she'd let me talk. And I'd get home at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be like, oh my God, it's another day I haven't drank. And it was my first experience of talking to another woman, where I felt like it was all right. No matter what I said, she had no judgment about it. She wasn't trying to give me the steps to do, and she wasn't telling me to turn, give it to Jesus, whatever, any of that. She was just like listening to me and buying me coffee, because I had no money at all. No money at all. And I started to walk to all these meetings, and, you know, I had my first real lesson when I was about 3 months sober. There used to be that meeting on Wednesday night, I'd walk, and I'd be in my cherry glow-in-the-dark tracksuit, and I'd be walking. And it was like a 2.5 hour walk or a 3 hour walk. I have sponsees now who won't walk around the corner. Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, where were you? And they're like, nobody gave me a lift. And I'm like, what? What? You live in California. Walk. I'm tired. You don't work. What do you mean you're tired? Like, what? No. Get your ass there. I'll give you a lift home. Right. So it's like, thank you. Thanks for affirming that. hardness. So, you know, oh my God. So then they'll be like, I'm like, get the, this is a California thing, I think. I'd never come across this in London. In California, I'd say to people, get the bus. And they go, what about if somebody sees me? Oh, you were pissing in the bushes last week. You don't, God forbid they see you on the bus. Oh, sorry, my bad. What was I thinking? I've never come across that anywhere else apart from California. What about somebody sees me on the bus? That's a thing I discovered. So, you know, it was like that. I started to walk everywhere. And I'd go to this meeting. And it was London, people. It was cold. Like, so get over yourselves. And I'm like, I'm walking, right? Walking. And I'll be in my cherry glow in the dark. And people would toot their horns. And I'd be giving them the bird, right? Because I'm like, they want a piece of this, right? Now I'm looking back, I'm like, nobody wanted a piece of that, Julie. You know, it's so crazy. I'm like, they want a piece of this. I'm giving them bird. Like, automatic, right? No thought process. I'm just doing what I feel like. Because I told you, I'm undisciplined. And I'd go to the meeting, and these Irish guys would go, Jesus, Julie, it's a 2.5-hour walk. Jesus, Julie, I saw you. I tooted the horn, you gave me the bird, and I thought, feck her, let her walk. And I was like, oh my God. Like, it was my first experience of going like, oh, you can see me? And like, my first experience of abusing somebody and having to tolerate their response. I wasn't used to that. So I started to go to that meeting, and this is an amazing thing. As soon as I practiced keeping my hands in my pocket when someone threw at the horn, I got a lot of lifts to that meeting. Who knew? So then people would say to me, oh, can you help put out the chairs? And I'm like, or put the chairs away. And I'm like, well, I'll put my chair away. And they're like, yeah, but could you help? And I go, well, I don't mind doing it tonight because I'm here. And I'm a good person. And they'd say, well, could you do it, like, could you come every Friday night? And I'm like, well, for how long? Like, I was offended. And they'd go, a year, because in London, it's a year commitment. And I'd be like, a year? Oh, hell no. Like, I'm here tonight, and I'm going to do it. But I'm not committing to anything, because what's going to happen is next Friday, something wonderful is going to happen to me, and I don't want to have to feel like I've be here and put out chairs. I'm 25, for God's sake. No. So, like, I couldn't quite understand the idea of committing somewhere, like having a regular routine. Or people would say, could you help with the tea and coffee? I'm like, I don't drink tea and coffee, which is a total lie, I do. Or they'd say, could you help with the ashtray? I don't smoke. Like, why are you asking me to do stuff that other people should be doing? Like, I didn't get this idea of them trying to keep me busy and useful. I just didn't get it. And, you know, you see newcomers now, you're like, could you help with, they're like, I'm like, oh yeah, I get that, you know. But it's funny, I have a commitment on a Thursday night and it's all coffee mugs, and there's like, I may be about 140 people, it's all coffee mugs, and I'm on the cleanup crew, right? And my sponsee says, you know, I came back to this meeting because they had real coffee mugs. And she's like, I'm so glad that you're doing the commitment, because then I get to do the commitment with you. And we've been doing it together for like 18 months now, which is kind of lovely. But at that time, you know, I didn't understand any of that stuff, and I didn't understand this discipline. And I started to learn very quickly that in order for me to feel better, I had to have some discipline in my life, and I had to show up regularly. I didn't like it. It went through everything in my body. And saying that, like, I just felt better when I went to meetings. That grace period, right? I just went to meetings and I felt better. I didn't want to do steps. I had a hard time reading and writing and all that stuff. So I wasn't up for that. And about a couple of years, well, about a year sober, I started to learn to read and write properly. A friend of mine, I don't know about properly, but I started to learn to write, get me by. A friend of mine taught me how to do my ABCs and showed me how to use a dictionary. And then showed me how to read a newspaper and look at words that I didn't understand. And I started to build it up so I could start thinking about reading, right? So I'm on the train one day, I remember it so clearly, and I'd never read the big book because, you know, I had a hard time reading. And I open up the big book, and you know where it says, half measures availed us nothing? I thought for 3 years that people were reading, half measures of ale did nothing. And so I'm like, oh, Julie, alcoholic. Yeah, a half measure of ale. I've never had half a measure of ale. And people are like, And when I read that, I was mortified. I was like, oh my God, you moron. Like, so, you know. So I started to read a little bit, and I started to feel a bit better about myself. And I want to say, you know, my first 18 months, I had like two feelings. I was either super angry, and I mean angry, or I was super depressed. Nothing in between. Nothing in between. There was nothing else. I had two states, you know. And somebody in the house would go to me. Somebody who, they're not, it's not a recovery home or any of that. People are just taking a year out for college. And they're all polite, you know, middle class, polite people. And they're like, morning, Julie, how are you? Oh my God, did I tell you I was abused when I was 5? Damn. Like, I mean, like, no, nothing, no filter. And people, so I started to learn a little bit, kind of, like, I've always worked out, I've always exercised because I am wired in that way. And I started to kind of think before I speak. And I started to go to, I got accepted into this program at school. And I'm like, look, I haven't got any formal education. And I was 26. I haven't got any formal education, but I really want to do this. And because of the work I'd been doing in the youth service, they gave me a chance. And I'll tell you, my first paper, right, it was at the YMCA in London, and I was going to school. Nobody in my family had ever gone to college, ever, ever. I told you, both my parents, my mother left school when she was 15, pregnant, that was it. And my dad was totally illiterate. And so education was not a big thing. And so I'm like, oh, they accepted me. And so I'm at the YMCA, and I get my first assignment. And I do the first assignment. I have no clue what I'm doing. First assignment. I get the assignment back. And the pass mark is, I think, 34. 34, right? And everybody in the class is like, oh, my God, I got 97. Hey, I got 95. Hey, I got 90. What did you get? And I couldn't look at the paper. Because I knew that I was a loser. I knew I was a loser. It kills me to think about it now. I knew that I was just kidding myself. People like me don't go to school. I don't get to have an education. I don't do that. I clean and I do laundry like my mother. She worked in a laundromat for... My mother was a very smart woman. But she worked in a laundromat for a long time, and 15 years or something. And it's like, that's what I do. That's where I come from. And I couldn't look at that paper. And I put it in my room for like 3 days. And I was frightened because I knew the jig was up once I turned it over and saw that I'd failed. That was it. And I wanted to enjoy it a little bit. You know, I wanted to enjoy it a little bit. And I finally turned the paper over and I got 34. I passed. I got 34. Now everybody else got 96 and 97 and I got 34. And that was enough for me because I'm like, oh my God, I passed. I passed. I went to my meeting, I told everybody I passed. And that gave me enough. Since that time, you know, I got my associates, and then they asked me to stay on to do my bachelor's. I got my bachelor's. I got a master's. I got another master's. I got a doctorate a couple of years ago. I'm at work, and people call me doctor, and I'm like, oh, sorry. You know, it's like, oh, like, I didn't know that about me, right? I didn't know that about me. And because of the disciplines here I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted more for myself, and I wanted to build on that. I didn't know that I was ambitious or that I was driven. I had no clue. Alcohol just kept me in a place where I was violent and chaotic. That was it. And it wanted to take me back for a long, long time. And thank God I got myself busy. I exercised a lot. I worked at night. And I had a very rough time. I lived at the YMCA, and people were getting raped in the toilets. It was a rough place where I lived. And I had no money. Like, it's funny now, newcomers look at me and they go, oh, it's okay for you. But you're looking at 26 years of sobriety. You're looking at 26 years of consistency, right? When I first got sober, I was living at the YMCA in the East End of London. I had no money. I had £10 a week for food. And I had no fridge. And I'd go to AA meetings and they'd give me the milk to put in the window to keep the milk cold. That's how I lived for a long time. And I couldn't use the restroom at night because people were getting raped in those toilets at night. And I was bathing in the sink and going across the road to the college where I could go to the restroom and do what I needed to do over there. And I lived like that for, like, I was in that place for over a year. And I didn't have any money to walk to my job. School finished at 4 o'clock. My job started at 7. It would take me 3 hours to walk to my job. And then somebody there would give me a lift home. So I get kind of pissed off, you know, people. I don't apologize for what I have. I've worked really hard for it, and I've had some really tough times. And so don't mistake 26 years for, like, getting sober and, like, thinking, oh, I can't get sober because, look, you're all right. It's like, that was never how it was for me. It was a very rough start for me. And, you know, I've built a life for myself here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to want to do the steps. I turned about 3 years sober, and I thought, this is what happened, to be honest. I was with my wife, who I'm still married to 25 years later, and she said something. I was pissed off, and she said something that I didn't like, and I kicked the door in her face. And she shot back, missed her, and she started crying. And I had another moment of clarity, like, because I can sound good. You drop me in anywhere, I'll figure out what you want from me, and I'll give it to you. Right? And you can just wander off then, can't you? How about that? Right? Well, what am I doing when no one's looking? Right? Step 7. Like, what am I doing when the door is closed and no one's looking? How am I treating me in the dark? And how am I treating the people I love? And here I was, kicking the door in her face. There you go. 3 years sober. Boom! She shot back. I slid down the wall. I started crying. And I was like, I'm sorry, I'm going to do something about this anger. And she believed me because she saw me doing the action. It wasn't just like, oh, yeah, sorry about that. You know, I got a sponsor straight away. And that was really hard for me because I didn't trust people and I wasn't interested in people giving me any direction. But that humiliated me enough, and I mean humiliated me enough, to get a sponsor. And I got a sponsor who was an Irish woman, and she was frightening the life out of me. She was older than I was, and she was kind, and I don't do kind at this time in my life. And she'd say, hello, Julie, love, how are you? And she'd hug me, and I'd be like, oh my God. Like, she's touching me. You know, it was like, ugh. But I knew it was good for me that I didn't know how to be kind. And I remember having a moment of clarity that I was in the East End of London, and I was really hungry one day, and I had £10 on me to get food. And I went into the shop to get a sandwich. And there was a sandwich for £2, and there was a sandwich for £2.50, right? And I really want the £2.50 sandwich. And I wouldn't let myself have it. I forced myself to get the £2 sandwich. And I cried when I came out of that shop. I'm like, look how you treat yourself. Like, so I had all these different moments of clarity, like, where I was realized I was so rough with myself all the time. And when I'm rough with me, I'm going to be even rougher with you. Because, you know, I'm a hard taskmaster. I'm a hard taskmaster on me. I'm going to be a hard taskmaster on you. And so I started to, she started to be kind to me, and I didn't understand it, but I wanted to understand it. I wanted to understand how to be kind to myself, and she started to take me through the steps. Now, I'm somebody who's like, putting out of the minds the wrongs, you know, others had done. Where were we to blame? What now? What? No, you got twisted. I am a victim, right? I was only defending myself. You don't understand the life I had, and I had I had a rough upbringing. I'm just defending myself here. And then I start looking at putting them out of my mind. What was I? And I realized I wasn't a very kind person. I know, shocker. I wasn't a very kind person. I wasn't a good daughter. And I realized I kept everybody at arm's length. Like, I could be super depressed, which I've always struggled with in my sobriety. Thank God for Bill Wilson, who talks about that. Always struggled with depression. Bill Wilson talked about that in the letters to Father Dowling. It's a great book to read. So thank God for that, right? He was never shy about that experience. But, you know, I had always put myself in a place where, you know, I wanted something different for myself. And I ended up getting a sponsor and going through that and looking at what kind of person. And I realized people could call me and I'd be super depressed, my sisters, and I'd be like, ah, Jesus, no, I'm grand. What's going on with you? And I would be like super depressed. Like, I would never let people in. And then that's why I felt so isolated and so alone. I always performed for people. So you could stay right there. I would never want to be vulnerable with anybody. And that was such a detriment to me. And I had to learn the hard way. It's all right to be vulnerable to one or two people, Julie. It's all right. And I started to be able to say, you know, I'm having a bit of a rough day. And it was kind of a shift for me. So I did these columns, you know. And I was able, my mother, you know, I could identify myself and my mother, because my mother was the same kind of drunk as I was. And I understood that she was caught up in something bigger than herself. I understood that. And so that was kind of more palatable for me. I had a very difficult relationship with my father. And I was froze every time I thought about him. And so I did some step work and I looked at those relationships. And I went home and I, you know, my mother, I got my bachelor's degree. My mother came all the way from Ireland to Canterbury Cathedral, right? And I just finished all my step work. and the hatred that I had left me. And I hadn't seen my mom. She'd came all the way, and she was in the cathedral. And I've got my hat and gown on, and trumpets are blowing. And I'm like delighted with myself, 5 years sober. And I see my mom, and she turns around, and I know she's hungover, as she was every morning of my life. Hungover, and she was awkward and uncomfortable. And I knew the steps were working because I was delighted she was there. And I knew she'd got on a train, a plane, and another couple of trains, and then tried to find her way to that cathedral all on her own, hung over. And I knew she was hung over because she was celebrating me all night. Jesus, my daughter's getting a degree tomorrow, first in the family, have a drink, right? I knew that, and I was delighted. It was my first experience of catching eyes at my mother and loving her. And because of that, I was able to build. I brought her to the airport that night and I gave her a hug, which we don't do in my family. If you're going to have any physical contact, you have to duck real quick. You know what I'm saying? Hey, nearly. You know. I hug my mom and she whispers, "I'm so proud of you." And she leaves. And it was a powerful experience for me to be able to build that relationship. I get sad talking about my mom passed away like 18 months ago, and it's still hard for me. You know, it's still hard for me. I'm going home to Ireland on Monday, and it's hard for me to think about not seeing her when I go home. I'm flying out on Monday, we're flying out. My godmother's very sick and we're going home to spend some time. But it's hard for me to think about not seeing my mom. And that relationship with my mom started to get really healed. And later on, she started to get Alzheimer's, and I was in the nursing home with her, and I sat on the bed with her a couple of years ago, and I made a funny joke. I thought it was funny. And my mother grabbed my cheek, and it was the first time I didn't flinch. And she goes, "Look at your fat little cheeks," and we laughed. And then I bring her into the car, and I put her in the car, right? And as I'm putting the seatbelt on her, she thinks I'm hugging her. She gives me the biggest hug, and I'm like, oh, catches me off guard, you know? And with the Alzheimer's, she'd say to me, "Come on, Julie, do you want to lie down here next to me?" And everything in me is like, "No, I don't." And I'd go, "All right, ma'am, let's do that then." And I was able to, the Alzheimer's in that way was such a gift to me. I was able to be tender with my mother. And my mother was able to be tender to me. And it was amazing. Like, I was sitting with her one day, and I have scars on my arms, you know, from the cutting. And I'm talking, and my mom stops me. She looks at my arms. She looks at me. She doesn't speak. And I go, "I know, ma'am, it was just part of my drinking." And she starts to cry sitting on the chair. Like, in that moment, she had her own experience that she was so caught up in her own stuff. And she realized that I'd struggled, you know. So I'd had some very powerful moments with my mother. And we came back. Hilda was speaking at a convention in Hawaii 18 months ago. We get back on the Monday. Saturday morning, 3 a.m., my phone rings. Mammy had a heart attack and died. And I'm like, I get on a flight that night. Hilda comes with me. I go home, I'm appropriate. I just turned 25 years sober. I put the chip in my mum's hand. She got buried with the 25-year chip. And we were able to tell each other we loved each other on a regular basis. Like, that's amazing to me. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's like, I never outgrow this program. I can have all the degrees in the world, but that is something very, very different. And you know... When I went home for the funeral, my siblings said to me, "Will you do her eulogy?" "Oh, great Jesus, I'm only the second youngest. Why do you want me to do it?" Now, they've never heard me speak. They've never heard any of that. But they said to me, you know, we know and Mammy knew that you spoke in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we think that Mammy would really like you to speak at her funeral. So I got the privilege of speaking, do my mother's eulogy and picking the music for her and having that experience. And it was a very powerful experience for me. And, you know, like I said, I still miss her. I've been thinking about it. I think about missing her when I go home. It's hard, you know, it's hard. But that's how it is, right? And, you know, my father was an interesting thing. And this is my experience. It's not a popular experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. It happens to be mine. And so it doesn't have to be yours. It's just mine. There was so much damage with my father. My father was a very unwell guy. And I stopped hating my father after doing some step work. And then I became numb. And numb was good for a long time. I didn't have any contact with him. And then he had a brain aneurysm when I was 9 years sober. And my sisters went home to Ireland and I went to California on a vacation. And they're like, aren't you coming home? And I was like, yeah, well, I've got a California vacation booked, so that's why I'm off to. Halfway through that vacation, I was at an AA convention. I knew I needed to go home. So I went home and faced my father, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in all my years of sobriety. My dad, I go into the hospital, and he's in the bed, he's asleep. And the hatred came back up in me, the anger, and I was really caught off guard. I hadn't seen him for like 4 years. And the nurse comes over and says, do you want me to wake him up, love? And I'm like, no, thanks. And I left. He never knew I was there, and I left. And I went to an AA meeting that night, and somebody said to me, what? And I shared, like, oh my God, this caught me totally off guard. I'm like, right there, back in that anger. And they said, why don't you read page 552 of the big book, which, you know, you pray for somebody for 2 weeks. And I was like, I'm reading it as I'm going out the meeting because I really want relief. I don't like feeling this, you know. You know, when you get a bit of sobriety, you don't like feeling dysregulated after that, do you? When you get a bit of peace, it's like you know when you're off, you know. I don't like it anymore. And so I end up, reading this. And I go in the next day, my dad's awake and he looks terrible. He's blind in one eye. He's had this massive brain aneurysm. He's in a wheelchair. And I let him hug me. And I bring him to the garden and I wipe his mouth and we have nothing, So I go to an AA meeting that night, I talk about it, and I go back the next day and I finally tell my dad, you know, I just go to him and I say, you know, I want you to know that I'm leaving now and I won't see you again. Now, I made that decision because of a couple of incidents that happened. I kept going back in my sobriety thinking, it's going to be different this time, it's going to be different this time, and it never was. And I had to make a mature decision to acknowledge my father for who he was. And it's just somebody I could not have in my life anymore. And now my siblings, one of my siblings didn't understand that. Well, they don't have to. I'm not asking for anybody's permission here. I'm merely telling you what's going on. That's it. So I was like, I said goodbye to my father and I said, I'm not going to see you again. I'm going to California to live. And he started to cry. And he goes, I'm going to miss you now. And in that moment, there was a knowing. We knew, boy. And I was like, and I left, I went into the chapel and I cried for about an hour. And I felt so much relief because I realized I had so much resentment towards my father, so much anger, that any man that came in my direction, I'd be like, yeah, I know what you want. I know what you're up to. I know what I had no clue that was going on until I actually had the courage to face my father. But I was 9 years sober when I faced him. Sometimes I have new people who want to do it all. And I'm like, hey, it's not your time, it's God's time. It's God's time. And so that's my experience. It's not necessarily a popular experience. It happens to be mine. And I went back and my brother called me and said, I think daddy's dying. You should probably come home. A couple of years later. And so I did. I got on a flight. My flight got cancelled, right, in LAX. It got cancelled. And in the line, me and 200 other people, I get a call. Daddy just died as I'm in the line. And they're like 8 hours ahead in Ireland. And so I go to the reception. I start to cry. It catches me off guard. I'm like weeping and weeping. And I go to the receptionist and I tell her. And they get me on a flight. And then I fly to New York. And then I fly to Chicago. And then I fly. I got there. This is like Friday night. I got there Sunday morning. And I cried the whole time. And I called my sponsor. And I'm like, you know. Blah, 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 blah. And she goes, do you ever think this is God's way of giving you a bit of space to cry and do what you need to do before you have to go home and face your family. And I'm like, no, I don't. It sucks, I'm here on my own, right? And I have been for the last 48 hours. But she was absolutely right. And I was able to go home and have some dignity, and I was able to go to my father's graveside and have a conversation with my father and just say to him, look, I'd like to think that you understand why I made the decisions I made. I'd like to think that when people pass away, they get to see the whole picture and not just the small little, you hurt my feeling, right? That's what I like to think. And I was able to have that, and I had a lovely closure experience with my dad, just cried at his grave and had that. And I have no regrets about my actions that I took in my sobriety with that relationship. I have no regrets about that. It's perfect. And I handled myself with some respect and some dignity. And that's all can be asked, you know. And so I wanna kind of finish up that. Yeah, my mother raised me. They lived together for like 20 years. And she's really sick, cancer. Cancer came back. And I'm going home to spend some time with her. And my wife is coming with me. And I'm anxious about it. Like, she's lost 40 pounds in the last couple of months, and I don't want to have to face it. She was always my little safe spot, and I don't want to face it, but I will, and I'll have my regular meetings there, and I'll show up, and I'll be kind, and I'll try and do the best I can, and we'll talk about funeral arrangements, right? And that's how we do it here, right? We have some courage, and we know that we're not doing it on our own. When my mother died, I flew in. We had the funeral, and in the corner of my eye, seven people out of my home group that I have in Ireland were standing by the door. And I hadn't even seen them. I hadn't even had a chance to go to a meeting. I was burying my mother like the day after I got there. So they were standing there waiting for me. And they were super respectful. They came up and gave me a big love. And they came to the service, and they loved me on the way out, and then they left. And so I know I'm not doing it on my own, but these things are hard to face. I don't want to face them, but I will, and I am. And thank God my wife has come on with me. And, you know, I'm just going to show up and try. God's in charge. I'm going to try and get out of my own way. I'm going to try and get out my own way. And so I'll say this: I wake up in the morning. I still wake up anxious. Right? I think to myself, this is my very first thought every morning. Oh my God, what day is it? And who wants something from me? Now my wife wakes up singing. Now, which I think is creepy. Which she's also alcoholic. So it's not because I'm alcoholic I wake up like that. It's just my personality. And so I kind of do some prayer meditation in the morning. I get quiet. I don't do anything fancy. I read the big book. Imagine that. I'm not levitating for an hour and then being a total ass at work. You know what I mean? Like, but I levitated for an hour. Oh, awesome. Great. Perhaps you should tell your attitude that. So I pray in the morning. I do step 86 to 88. I do that. And then I read page 130, and it says, we've come to believe in a God who'd like to keep our head in the clouds with him, but our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. Why? And here's the bad news. Because that is where our fellow travellers are. Oh, no! That's the worst news you can give someone like me. That's where our fellow travellers are. That's where the work must be done. So that's the name of the game, right? So I get to show up and I get to say yes when I've been asked, whether I'm anxious about going home to Ireland or not, whether I worked today or not. I get to drive and we get to have a good time and be grateful that I'm sober. So thank you for letting me share.